Hello again, listeners. This is Todd Maxwell, a member of the Bureau of Justice Assistance Body-Worn Camera Team, and today I'm speaking with Jay Stanley, Senior Policy Analyst with the American Civil Liberties Union. Jay Stanley is a Senior Policy Analyst with ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, where he researches, writes, and speaks about technology-related privacy and civil liberties issues in their future. He's the editor of ACLU's Free Future blog, has authored and co-authored a variety of influential ACLU reports on privacy and technology topics. Before joining ACLU, he was an analyst at the technology research firm Forrester, served as an American politics editor at Facts on Files World News Digest, and as national newswire editor at MediaLink. He is a graduate of Williams College and holds an MA in American History from the University of Virginia. Jay, thank you for speaking with me today. And recently there's been a lot of debate about whether an officer can review BWC footage before writing a report. Some agencies allow all this footage to be reviewed by an officer, some don't allow it at all, while others allow it to be reviewed, but only if there's not a use of force investigation. In those cases, it varies whether the officer can review pre or post initial incident report. You even wrote a paper on the topic that was briefly covered in a video for the launch of the BWC toolkit. Can you elaborate on the thoughts and the position of the ACLU on the matter of officers reviewing footage?
Yeah, sure. So to us, this is really a no-brainer. Officers should be required to give an initial version of their events before they watch the body-worn camera video. There's a couple reasons for this. Number one, letting officers view a video before they give an account enables those officers who do have something to hide to lie. They can see that maybe the video swings away at one moment, and they can claim, well, that's the moment where he reached for his waistband or what have you. But even for hopefully the vast majority of officers who don't have any reason to hide anything, you know, watching a video actually literally changes your memory of what took place. And there are numerous studies that show this. All the studies show this. You know, memory is a very, very fragile thing. And there are, you know, the video is not an objective record of what takes place. As any first year film student knows, it depends on lighting and camera angle and when it's turned on and when it's turned off. And of course, human memory is not an objective thing of what record of what took place. And so we need to capture both sets of data before allowing one to infect the other. You know, your memory of what you viewed is literally changed by viewing the video. And that can actually, you know, that can play both ways. There are some times where an officer has been shown a video and sees something that he didn't remember and didn't see at the time, and finds himself struggling to explain what's on the video. And they ask him what took place, and he said, well, I could have sworn this took place, but I see on the video that it was different, so, you know, I don't know what to say. Now I think police officers have a concern that, you know, there's a game of gotcha going on here, and that you know, not showing officers video is just a way to try and catch them up. But I think that, you know, every other member of the criminal justice system has to deal with that and the inevitable, you know, minor differences between what is on a video and what they remember. And police officers shouldn't be the only participants in a criminal justice system whose recollection magically matches up with a video, which gives them an artificial credibility in court and skews, you know, the criminal justice system. This is not about treating officers with suspicion. It's about what is the best way to get at the truth of what happened when there are differing memories and different versions of what happened. And I think all the science shows that, you capture the person's subjective memory of the experience before you contaminate that memory by showing them the video. Now, of course, after they give their first account, there's nothing wrong with them showing the video, and they can, if their memory is jogged by things in the video that they hadn't remembered, they can offer additional explanation and what have you.
Great. I know if you recall, at our expert panel, we had some people from the UK and other countries where their officers are actually allowed to use it and they're treated as expert witnesses and they testify to what's on the video and such. How do you see that differing here in the U.S.? Do you think it's because of perception of law enforcement?
I'm sorry, in the UK they were not allowed to view the video?
No, they are. They allowed to review it and they're considered expert witnesses so they can get on.
Right. Well, you know, and first of all, let me also add that, you know, we're talking about critical incidents here, you know, not talking about necessarily the daily routine where an officer might use a video as sort of, you know, a way to jog their memory in routine petty cases. But, you know, I think that a lot of police departments here are allowing their officers to review maybe more than are not. There are some that have what we regard as a better policy and it works fine for them. But, you know, I think the UK has a more standardized national policy, whereas we have, you know, thousands and thousands of departments, many of which have come up with their own independent policy. So I think we're all over the map.
Yeah, and I think you hit it on the head. Is the policies around use of force is the main one that's the contention point here. So that's going to sort of lead me to my next question, is that community arguments often arise on the video review by an officer because victims, witnesses, and suspects are not allowed to review those videos before giving statements or testifying in court. How would you guys resolve this, or what ideas would you offer to resolve this dilemma?
Well, I think that the dilemma, it's not a dilemma unless you think that the officers should be allowed to preview the video. For us, it's not a dilemma. We think that everybody should give an initial statement before their memories are contaminated by viewing the video, and then everybody's on an equal footing. And you know, there will be cases. You know, human nature inevitably will. I mean, human memory will inevitably differ from the video. You know, the human mind focuses with laser-like intensity on certain things in a scene and misses, you know, sometimes very large things that are happening in a scene. But again, everybody has to deal with that, and I think that we, as judges, juries, prosecutors, and the general public, we have to become sophisticated consumers of video and understand that just because something's on a video doesn't mean that it was necessarily perceived at the time by anybody, whether it's the officer or a suspect or witnesses. And there's a lot of, you know, of studies that have been done to back that up. That said, sometimes what happens in the video is very plain and very obvious, and it helps everybody to understand what took place.
Right. I was at a recent victims advocacy group meeting, and there's discussion around FOIA requests to police departments. And the victim advocacy group thought that victims of crime should have the final say on whether video should be released to the public and media because it can further victimize them. Do you have any opinions on that matter?
Yeah, we first confronted and had to think about this issue when we were dealing with a case in New Hampshire in which a mentally ill man was fatally shot by the police. And there was an investigation. The local press, you know, put in a public records request for the video. After the investigation was over, the police moved to release the video. And then it was actually the survivors of the deceased man who insisted that it not be released. You know, that again, it was sort of the same sort of dynamic. They were arguing that the dignity of their family member was at stake, and so forth. We ultimately decided that when push comes to shove, there is such a strong public interest in monitoring how a police department is using force, especially deadly force, that public interest trumps the privacy interests of individuals who may be involved in incidents. You know, there are things, you know, obviously video can be redacted so that individuals who are not, you know, crucial, you know, who are victims can be, can have their dignity preserved to the greatest extent possible. But we can't allow victims to exercise a veto over the public's broader and really crucial right to exercise oversight over how its police force uses force.
Yeah, it's a complicated topic, so thanks for sharing your thoughts on it.
Yeah, it is complicated.
During the recent site visit to a police department that was brought to our attention, the city prosecutor told that police department that when they draft their BWC policy, they need to consider the Fourth Amendment when using BWCs in a person's home. The prosecutor advised that the department to get permission from the homeowner to film them when they enter that home. This raises a few concerns that because if the homeowner is a suspect in alleged domestic violence crime and does not want the officer filming his physically abused spouse, then he could decline to have officers do this. What is your interpretation of the Fourth Amendment privacy rights around a person's home versus an officer's duty to investigate crime, especially one like domestic violence?
Well, I think the starting point has to be that, you know, you do have very, very strong privacy rights in the home, stronger than anywhere else in any other set of circumstances. And if you don't want the government filming inside your home, you should be able to stop the government from filming inside your home. Again, that's the baseline. Now, sometimes there are police raid homes because they have a warrant. They engage in SWAT raids and so forth, and we recommend that cameras always be on during SWAT raids and other non-consensual entries. If there are exigent circumstances, then the police do have the right to enter somebody's home without a warrant. And in those circumstances, the cameras should be on. If there's if somebody calls over a reported noise complaint or somebody screaming, and the officer shows up, and it turns out that there's exigent circumstances that do justify entry into the home without a warrant, then the cameras should remain on. Otherwise, what we've recommended is a policy in which officers, before entering a home in any kind of consensual way, are required to ask permission of the homeowner if the camera should stay on, and if the homeowner requests that it be turned off, then it be turned off. And that's for routine entry cases. That said, there are very difficult situations, and we don't have all the answers for that. A situation where an officer shows up and one person says, "I want the camera off," and the other resident says, "I want it on." I guess I don't really know what the answer is in those cases. That's a very tough situation. I do believe that the jurisprudence in terms of entry, where one roommate invites the officer in, the other roommate says, "No, I don't want the officer in the house," I believe the jurisprudence is that the roommate who has invited the officer in trumps the interest of the other roommate, but I'm not sure whether it makes sense to apply that to body cameras.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, and it was the first time they've been brought up to me rather recently, so I'll be interested to see where this actually goes and how it affects policy. When it comes to retaining BWC video, I know you've stated your thoughts on the topic recently, but can you state what the ACLU's position on retention of video in non-criminal case for our listeners who might not have seen that?
Yeah, so we recommend that most video really be put into a lockbox and nothing be done with it. That certain video be flagged where there's a use of force or there's been a complaint against a police officer, for example. But the vast majority of video, which is not really of any interest to the public, showing daily police work, the privacy invasions there are potentially very significant, and that video be stored for 6 months, which is long enough for somebody to come forward and file a complaint in most jurisdictions, and then deleted, and not subject to analytics like face recognition, not poured over by police management. We think that an officer should have access to his or her own video, but that police management shouldn't be looking at it unless brought to the attention of management by the officer, him or herself. Again, this is assuming it's not been flagged. and again destroyed after 6 months. And I think this is the best balance in terms of privacy while preserving the public oversight function of the video. If video is flagged because there's a use of force or what have you, which we call for it to be retained for 3 years, although of course if it's evidence in a criminal proceeding, it should be retained right. According to whatever the normal evidence handling policies are at that jurisdiction.
Yeah, that raises an interesting topic, though, because a lot of agencies are starting to look at 90-day retention policies, which would go against the 6 month, but they're doing that purely because they're a large agency and the cost of retaining that non-violent, non-criminal-related case is just skyrocketing. So they're having to do that. So it'd be interesting to see how you manage the cost that eventually the taxpayers are paying versus that privacy. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for police departments which are dealing with, you know, something pretty new that's not really their core historical competency, which is sort of data management and storage. Of course, many departments have outsourced that, but the cost can't be considerable, but I think that it's important for the public to pay certain costs to ensure that its police departments are working well. And it may be a different balance in some jurisdictions where there are more troubled relations between the police and the community, and others where there are less so. If somebody does come forward after 4 months and says that they were abused by a police officer in an encounter, it would be in the public interest for that video to still be on hand. I don't know what the numbers are in terms of how many people come forward with police complaints, in a period after 30 days or after 60 days or what have you. But it's a balance that should be looked at, but it should not just be money that's the only consideration.
Understood. Thank you. Recently, the ACLU sued a California police department over charging the fees for redacting videos involving FOIA requests. Can you tell us a little bit more about that case?
Sure. Yeah, that was a case where the National Lawyers Guild sued to get information, to get body camera video from a protest where there were a number of people who were subject pretty severe use of force by police officers. And the Hayward Police Department in Northern California charged the National Lawyers Guild $3,000 for redacting that and turning over that video. And so the ACLU of Northern California, our affiliate there, filed a lawsuit because those kinds of exorbitant fees threaten to totally undermine the public oversight purposes of open records laws. And so they sued under the provisions of the California open records laws, and the arguments centered around whether the California law permits fees for quote-unquote extraction, which seems to mean if the agency has to actually perform work to create new records, and the argument was whether the things that the police department had to do to turn over that video counted as quote-unquote extraction or whether it was mere redaction. And we're still awaiting the final ruling in that case.
I think as cases like this involving digital media or digital evidence sort of go forward, we might see a few more of these because of how the laws and the rules are written, and they weren't really set to pertain to this type of digital evidence. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, as so often happens these days, new technology renders the old law as a poor fit for the aims that the legislature was trying to carry out. And so you have to sort of re-argue things and how the existing law applies. The important thing is that, a journalist or a citizen who wants to see video of their encounter with police or any event of broad public interest, you know, that it be something that they can afford on average, so that the goals that the public open records laws were passed in order to reach are actually reached. The other thing is, I mean, hopefully over time, as this kind of digital evidence and video handling becomes routine, that technology will step in and help here and make it very fast and easy, so that, you know, that the public can gain access to footage that is of public interest without paying exorbitant fees, but also that departments can provide it without having to you know, use up many man hours doing so.
Right. Always takes a little bit to catch up.
Yeah.
But there, a final question for you. Are there any topics, other topics ACLU is focusing right now on around body cameras that our listeners should be aware of?
You know, I think that the main debates now are around public access, when the public does and does not get access to video. And that's something that we're really seeing a lot of divisions around the country, where, you know, some police departments are saying they're not going to release any video unless required to in a court of law, and others saying that they will, you know, and others being in states where the state law basically requires them to release video, sometimes to an excessive degree, in our view, when it comes to privacy rights. I think that one thing I've noticed is that the smart police departments do release their video, whether or not it's actually required by law, when there's a big public controversy, regardless of you know, and they say let the chips fall where they may in terms of what the video shows, because they understand that the whole purpose of body cam. I mean, body cam videos, body cameras obviously serve a number of purposes at the same time, but the reason that they are spreading so quickly, and that the ACLU, that civil rights groups support body cameras in many or most cases, is their oversight role. The reason that President Obama called for millions of dollars to be devoted to them was because of their oversight role. I think that the smart police departments realize that it can be a good way to improve trust between communities and police departments, regardless of how things work out in any one given case. If police departments have complete control over what's released, it will just end up being a police propaganda tool, where police departments release video of heroic officers doing heroic things, which there are, you know, will be many videos of, I'm sure, because there are many heroic officers out there. But they don't release the videos where the officers don't, you know, other officers maybe don't look so good. And long term, that's just not going to work, because when a department starts releasing video, the public is going to demand that other videos be released as well.
Right. Well, thank you for speaking with us today. I'm grateful you could share your knowledge on this important topic and the other topics we covered. We encourage law enforcement, justice, and public safety leaders whose agencies are interested in learning more about the implementation of body-worn cameras to visit the Body-Worn Camera Toolkit at www.bja.gov/BWC. This toolkit offers a variety of resources that agencies can use to help with the adoption and use for community engagement, policy development, data collection, officer training, and educational purposes. We also encourage listeners to share and promote these resources with your colleagues and staff. Lastly, all these resources, and especially the Body-Worn Camera Toolkit, have been designed as a national resource. It's your resource. So please submit your ideas for new content through the BWC support link at the bottom of the homepage. This is Todd Maxwell from Bureau of Justice Assistance, Body-Worn Camera Team, signing off. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today.